had to get stuck in lines like that. But then I recognized the man in the limousine up ahead of me. It was Adlai Stevenson. He wasn't moving any faster than I was, and his radiator was boiling too. One place there, we got stuck so long that Mr. Stevenson and I got out and walked around a little. I took the opportunity to ask him how the United Nations were getting along. He told me they were getting along about as well as could be expected. That wasn't anything I didn't already know. When I finally got to Hyannisport, I found out Irving Avenue was blocked off by police and Secret Service men. Adlai Stevenson got to go down it, but I didn't. The police made me get back into line with the tourists who were being shunted down a street one block over from Irving Avenue. The next thing I knew, I was in Hyannis, going past the Presidential Motor Inn, the First Family Waffle Shop, the PT-109 Cocktail Lounge, and a miniature golf course called the New Frontier. I went into the waffle shop and I called up the Rumfords to find out how an ordinary storm window salesman was supposed to get down Irving Avenue without dying in a hail of lead. It was the butler I talked to. He took down my license number and found out how tall I was and what color my eyes were and all. He said he would tell the Secret Service and they would let me by next time. It was late in the afternoon and I'd missed lunch, so I decided to have a waffle. All the different kinds of waffles were named after Kennedys and their friends and relatives. A waffle with strawberries and cream was a Jackie. A waffle with a scoop of ice cream was a Caroline. They even had a waffle named Arthur Schlesinger Jr. I had a thing called a Teddy and a cup of Joe. I got through next time, went right down Irving Avenue behind the Defense Minister of Pakistan. Except for us, that street was as quiet as a stretch of the Sahara Desert. There wasn't anything to see at all on the president's side, except for a new peeled cedar fence about 8 feet high and 200 feet long with a gate in it. The Rumford Cottage faced the gate from across the street. It was the biggest house and one of the oldest in the village. It was stucco. It had towers and balconies and a veranda that ran around all four sides. On a second-floor balcony was a huge portrait of Barry Goldwater. It had bicycle reflectors in the pupils of its eyes. Those eyes stared right through the Kennedy Gate. There were floodlights all around it, so I could tell it was lit up at night, and the floodlights were rigged with blinkers. A man who sells storm windows can never be really sure about what class he belongs to, especially if he installs the windows too, so I was prepared to keep out from underfoot and go about my business measuring the windows, but the Commodore welcomed me like a guest of great importance. He invited me to cocktails and dinner and to spend the night. He said I could start measuring the next day. So we had martinis out on the veranda. Only we didn't sit on the most pleasant side, which looked out on the yacht club dock and the harbor. We sat on the side that looked out on all the poor tourists being shunted off toward Hyannis. The Commodore liked to talk about all those fools out there.
"Look at them," he said. "They wanted glamour. Now they realize they're not going to get it. They actually expected to be invited to play touch football with Eunice and Frank Sinatra and the Secretary of Health and Welfare. Glamour is what they voted for, and look at them now. They don't even get to look at a Kennedy chimney up above the trees. All the glamour they'll get out of this administration is an overpriced waffle named Caroline."
A helicopter went over, very low, and it landed somewhere inside the Kennedy fence. Clarice said she wondered who it was.
"Pope John VI, said the Commodore.
The butler, whose name was John, came out with a big bowl. I thought it was peanuts or popcorn, but it turned out to be Goldwater buttons. The Commodore had John take the bowl out to the street and offer buttons to the people in cars. A lot of people took them. Those people were disappointed. They were sore. Some 50-mile hikers, who'd actually hiked 67 miles all the way from Boston, asked if they could please lie down on the Rumford lawn for a while. They were burned up, too. They thought it was the duty of the president, or at least the attorney general, to thank them for walking so far. The Commodore said they could not only lie down, but he would give them lemonade if they would put on Goldwater buttons. They were glad to. "Commodore," I said, "where's that nice boy of yours, the one who talked to us up in New Hampshire?"
"The one who talked to you is the only one I've got," he said.
"He certainly poured it on," I said.
"Chip off the old block," he said.
Clarice gave that faraway freight whistle sigh of hers again.
"The boy went swimming just before you got here," said the Commodore. "He should be back at any time, unless he's been decapitated by a member of the Irish Mafia on water skis."
We went around to the water side of the veranda to see if we could catch sight of young Robert Taft Rumford in swimming. There was a Coast Guard cutter out there, shooing tourists in motorboats away from the Kennedy Beach. There was a sightseeing boat crammed with people gawking in our direction. The barker on the boat had a very loud loudspeaker, and we could hear practically everything he said.
"The white boat there is the Honey Fitz, the president's personal yacht," said the barker. "Next to it is the Marlin, which belongs to the president's father, Joseph C. Kennedy, former ambassador to the court of St. James."
"President's stinkpot, and the president's father's stinkpot," said the Commodore.
He called all motorboats stinkpots.
"This is a harbor that should be devoted exclusively to sail."
There was a chart of the harbor on the veranda wall. I studied it and found a Rumford Point, a Rumford Rock, and a Rumford Shoal. The Commodore told me his family had been in Hyannisport since 1884. "There doesn't seem to be anything named after the Kennedys," I said.
"Why should there be?" he said. "They only got here day before yesterday."
"Day before yesterday," I said, and he asked me,
"What would you call 1921?
"No, sir," the barker said to one of his passengers. "That is not the president's house. Everybody asks that. That great, big, ugly stucco house, folks, that's the Rumford Cottage. I agree with you. It's too big to be called a cottage, but you know how rich people are."
"Demoralized and bankrupt by confiscatory taxation," said the Commodore. "You know," he said, "it isn't as though Kennedy was the first president we ever had in Hyannisport. Taft, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover were all guests of my father in this very house. Kennedy is simply the first president who's seen fit to turn the place into an eastern enclave of Disneyland."
"Now, ma'am," said the barker, "I don't know where the Rumfords get their money, but they don't have to work at all, I know that. They just sit on that porch there and drink martinis and let the old Mazuma roll in."
The Commodore blew up. He said he was going to sue the owners of the sightseeing boat for a blue million. His wife tried to calm him down, but he made me come into his study with him while he called up his lawyers.
"You're a witness," he said.
But his telephone rang before he could call his lawyers. The person who was calling him was a Secret Service agent named Raymond Boyle. I found out later that Boyle was known around the Kennedy household as the Rumford Specialist, or the Ambassador to Rumfordiana. Whenever anything came up that had to do with the Rumfords, Boyle had to handle it. The Commodore told me to go upstairs and listen in on the extension in the hall.
"This will give you an idea of how arrogant civil servants have become these days," he said.
So I went upstairs.
"The Secret Service is one of the least secret services I've ever come in contact with,"
the Commodore was saying when I picked up the phone.
I've seen drum and bugle corps that were less obtrusive. Did I ever tell you about the time Calvin Coolidge, who was also a president, as it happened, went fishing for scup with my father and me off the end of the yacht club dock?
Yes, sir, you have, many times, said Boyle. It's a good story, and I want to hear it again sometime. But right now, I'm calling about your son. The Commodore went right ahead with the story anyway.
President Coolidge, he said, insisted on baiting his own hook, and the combined Atlantic and Pacific fleets were not anchored offshore, and the sky was not black with airplanes, and brigades of Secret Service agents were not trampling the neighbors' flower beds to puree.
Sir, said Boyle patiently, your son, Robert, was apprehended in the act of boarding the president's father's boat, the Marlin.
Back in the day of Coolidge, there were no stinkpots like that in this village, dribbling petroleum products, belching fumes, killing the fish, turning the beaches a gummy black.
Commodore Rumford, sir, said Boyle, did you hear what I just said about your son?
Of course, said the Commodore. You said Robert, a member of the Hyannisport Yacht Club, was caught touching a vessel belonging to another member of the club. This may seem a very terrible crime to a landlubber like yourself, but it has long been a custom of the sea, Mr. Boyle, that a swimmer, momentarily fatigued, may, upon coming to a vessel not his own, grasp that vessel and rest without fear of being fired upon by the Coast Guard or of having his fingers smashed by members of the Secret Service, or, as I prefer to call them, the Kennedy Palace Dragoons.
There has been no shooting and no smashing, sir, said Boyle. There has also been no evidence of swimmer's fatigue. Your Robert went up the anchor line of the Marlin like a chimpanzee. He swarmed up that rope, Commodore. I believe that's the proper nautical term. And I remind you, as I tried to remind him, that persons moving, uninvited, unannounced, with such speed and purposefulness within the vicinity of a president, are, as a matter of time-honored policy, to be turned back at all costs. To be turned back, if need be, violently.
Was it a Kennedy who gave the order that the border be repelled?
The Commodore wanted to know. There was no Kennedy on board, sir.
The stink pot was unoccupied?
Adlai Stevenson and Walter Reuther and one of my men were on board, sir, said Boyle. They were all below until they heard Robert's feet hit the deck.
Stevenson and Reuther, said the Commodore. That's the last time I let my son go swimming without a dagger in his teeth. I hope he was opening the seacocks when beaten insensible by truncheons.
Very funny, sir, said Boyle, his voice developing a slight cutting edge.
You're sure it was my Robert, said the Commodore.
Who else but your Robert wears a gold water button on his swimming trunks? Asked Boyle.
You object to his political views?
The Commodore demanded. I mention the button as a means of identification. Your son's politics do not interest the Secret Service. For your information, I have spent 7 years protecting the life of a Republican and 3 protecting the life of a Democrat, said Boyle.
For your information, Mr. Boyle, said the Commodore, Dwight David Eisenhower was not a Republican.
Whatever he was, I protected him, said Boyle. He may have been a Zoroastrian, for all I know. And whatever the next president is going to be, I'll protect him, too. I also protect the lives of persons like your son from the consequences of excessive informality where the presidential presence is concerned. Now Boyle's voice really started to cut, It sounded like a bandsaw working on galvanized tin.
I tell you, officially and absolutely unsmilingly now, your son is to cease and desist from using Kennedy boats as love nests.
That got through to the Commodore, bothered him.
Love nests, he said.
Your Robert has been meeting a girl on boats all over the harbor, said Boyle. He arranged to meet her today on the Marlin. He was sure it would be vacant. Adlai Stevenson and Walter Reuther were a shock.
The Commodore was quiet for a few seconds, and then he said,
Mr. Boyle, I resent your implications. If I ever hear of your implying such a thing about my son to anyone else, you had better put your pistol and shoulder holster in your wife's name, because I'll sue you for everything you've got. My Robert has never gone with a girl he wasn't proud to introduce to his mother and me, and he never will.
You're going to meet this one any minute now, said Boyle. Robert is on his way home with her.
The Commodore wasn't tough at all now. He was uneasy and humble when he said,
Would you mind telling me her name?
Kennedy, sir, said Boyle. Sheila Kennedy, fresh over from Ireland, a fourth cousin of the President of the United States.
Robert Taft Rumford came in with a girl right after that and announced they were engaged to be married. Supper that night in the Rumford cottage was sad and beautiful and happy and strange. There were Robert and his girl and me and the Commodore and his lady. That girl was so intelligent, so warm, and so beautiful that she broke my heart every time I looked at her. That was why supper was so peculiar. The girl was so desirable, and the love between her and Robert was so sweet and clean that nobody could think of anything but silly little things to say. We mainly ate in silence. The Commodore brought up the subject of politics just once. He said to Robert,
Well, will you still be making speeches around the country?
I think I'll get out of politics entirely for a while, said Robert. The Commodore said something that none of us could understand because the words sort of choked him. Sir, said Robert.
I said
the Commodore,
I would think you would.
I looked at the Commodore's lady, at Clarice. All the lines had gone out of her face. She looked young and beautiful, too. She was completely relaxed for the first time in God knows how many years. One of the things I said that supper was sad. The sad part was how empty and quiet it left the Commodore. The two lovers went for a moonlight sail. The Commodore and his lady and I had brandy on the veranda on the waterside. The sun was down. The tourist traffic had petered out. The 50-mile hikers who had asked to rest on the lawn that afternoon were still all there, sound asleep, except for one boy who played a guitar. He played it slowly. Sometimes it seemed like a minute between the time he would pluck a string and the time he would pluck one again. John the butler came out and asked the Commodore if it was time to turn on Senator Goldwater's floodlights yet.
I think we'll just leave him off tonight, John, said the Commodore.
Yes, sir, said John.
I'm still for him, John, said the Commodore. Don't anybody misunderstand me. I just think we ought to give him a rest tonight.
Yes, sir, said John,
and he left. It was dark on the veranda, so I couldn't see the Commodore's face very well. The darkness and the brandy and the slow guitar let him start telling the truth about himself without feeling much pain.
Let's give the senator from Arizona a rest, he said. Everybody knows who he is. The question is, who am I?
A lovable man, said Clarice in the dark.
With Goldwater's floodlights turned off, and with my son engaged to marry a Kennedy, what am I but what the man on the sightseeing boat said I was? A man who sits on this porch, drinking martinis, and letting the old Mazuma roll in.
You're an intelligent, charming, well-educated man, and you're still quite young, said Clarice.
I've got to find some kind of work, he said.
We'll both be so much happier, she said. I would love you, no matter what. But I can tell you now, darling, it's awfully hard for a woman to admire a man who actually doesn't do anything.
We were dazzled by the headlights of two cars coming out of the Kennedy's driveway. The car stopped right in front of the Rumford cottage. Whoever was in them seemed to be giving the place a good looking over. The Commodore went to that side of the veranda to find out what was going on, and I heard the voice of the President of the United States coming from the car in front.
Commodore Rumford, said the President, may I ask what is wrong with your Goldwater sign?
Nothing, Mr. President, said the Commodore respectfully.
Then why isn't it on? Asked the President.
I just didn't feel like turning it on tonight, sir, said the Commodore.
I have Mr. Khrushchev's son-in-law with me, said the President. He would very much enjoy seeing it.
Yes, sir, said the Commodore.
He was right by the switch. He turned it on. The whole neighborhood was bathed in flashing light.
Thank you, said the President. And leave it on, would you please?
Sir, said the Commodore.
The car started to pull away slowly.
That way, said the President, I can find my way home.
D.P. Read by David Strathairn. 81 small sparks of human life were kept in an orphanage set up by Catholic nuns in what had been the gamekeeper's house on a large estate overlooking the Rhine. This was in the German village of Karlswald, in the American zone of occupation. Had the children not been kept there, not been given the warmth and food and clothes that could be begged for them, they might have wandered off the edges of the earth, searching for parents who had long ago stopped searching for them. Every mild afternoon, the nuns marched the children two by two through the woods into the village and back for their ration of fresh air. The village carpenter, an old man who was given to thoughtful rests between strokes of his tools, always came out of his shop to watch the bobbing, chattering, cheerful, ragged parade, and to speculate, with idlers his shop attracted, as to the nationalities of the passing children's parents.
"See the little French girl," he said one afternoon. "Look at the flash of those eyes. And look at that little Pole swing his arms. They love to march, the Poles," said a young mechanic. "Pole! Where do you see any Pole?" said the carpenter. "There, the thin, sober-looking one in front," the other replied. "Ah, he's too tall for a Pole," said the carpenter. "And what Pole has flaxen hair like that? He's a German." The mechanic shrugged. "They're all German now, so what difference does it make?" he said. "Who can prove what their parents were? If you had fought in Poland, you would know he was a very common type." "Look, look who's coming now," said the carpenter, grinning. "Full of arguments as you are, you won't argue with me about him. There we have an American." He called out to the child. "Joe, when you going to win the championship back?" "Joe," called the mechanic, "how is the brown bomber today?" At the very end of the parade, a lone, blue-eyed colored boy, 6 years old, turned and smiled with sweet uneasiness at those who called out to him every day. He nodded politely,
murmuring a greeting in German, the only language he knew. His name, chosen arbitrarily by the nuns, was Karl Heinz, but the carpenter had given him a name that stuck, the name of the only colored man who had ever made an impression on the villagers' minds, the former heavyweight champion of the world, Joe Lewis.
"Joe," called the carpenter, "cheer up. Let's see those white teeth sparkle, Joe."
Joe obliged shyly. The carpenter clapped the mechanic on the back.
"And if he isn't the German, too, maybe it's the only way we can get another heavyweight champion."
Joe turned a corner, shooed out of the carpenter's sight by a nun bringing up the rear. She and Joe spent a great deal of time together, since Joe, no matter where he was placed in the parade, always drifted to the end.
"Joe," she said, "you are such a dreamer. Are all your people such dreamers?"
"I'm sorry, sister," said Joe. "I was thinking."
"Dreaming?"
"Sister, am I the son of an American soldier?"
"Who told you that?"
"Peter. Peter said my mother was a German and my father was an American soldier who went away. He said she left me with you and then went away too."
There was no sadness in his voice, only puzzlement. Peter was the oldest boy in the orphanage, an embittered old man of 14, a German boy who could remember his parents and brothers and sisters and home and the war and all sorts of food that Joe found impossible to imagine. Peter seemed superhuman to Joe, like a man who had been to heaven and hell and back many times and knew exactly why they were where they were, how they had come there, and where they might have been.
"You mustn't worry about it, Joe," said the nun. "No one knows who your mother and father were, but they must have been very good people because you are so good."
"What is an American?" said Joe.
"It's a person from another country."
"Near here?"
"There are some near here, but their homes are far, far away, across a great deal of water."
"Like the river?"
"More water than that, Joe. More water than you have ever seen. You can't even see the other side. You could get on a boat and go for days and days and still not get to the other side. I'll show you a map sometime, but don't pay any attention to Peter, Joe. He makes things up. He really doesn't know anything about you. Now, catch up."
Joe hurried and overtook the end of the line, where he marched purposefully and alertly for a few minutes, but then he began to dawdle again, chasing ghost-like words in his small mind. Soldier. German. American. Your people. Champion. Brown bomber. More water than you've ever seen.
"Sister," said Joe, "are Americans like me? Are they brown?"
"Some are, some aren't, Joe."
"Are there many people like me?"
"Yes, many, many people. Why haven't I seen them?"
"None of them have come to the village. They have places of their own. I want to go there."
"Aren't you happy here, Joe?"
"Yes, but Peter says I don't belong here, that I'm not a German, and never can be."
"Peter, pay no attention to him.
Why do people smile when they see me and try to make me sing and talk and then laugh when I do?"
"Joe, Joe, look quickly," said the nun. "See, up there, in the tree. See the little sparrow with the broken leg? Oh, poor, brave little thing. He still gets around quite well. See him, Joe? Hop, hop, hippity-hop."
One hot summer day, as the parade passed the carpenter's shop, the carpenter came out to call something new to Joe, something that thrilled and terrified him.
"Joe! Hey, Joe! Your father's in town! Have you seen him yet?"
"No, sir. No, I haven't," said Joe. Where is he?
He's teasing, said the nun sharply.
You see if I'm teasing, Joe, said the carpenter. Just keep your eyes open when you go past the school. You'll have to look sharp, up the slope and into the woods. You'll see, Joe.
I wonder where our little friend the sparrow is today, said the nun brightly. Goodness, I hope his leg is getting better. Don't you, Joe?
Yes, yes, I do, sister.
She chattered on about the sparrow and the clouds and the flowers as they approached the school, and Joe gave up answering her. The woods above the school seemed still and empty. But then Joe saw a massive brown man, naked to the waist and wearing a pistol, step from the trees. The man drank from a canteen, wiped his lips with the back of his hand, grinned down on the world with handsome disdain, and disappeared again into the twilight of the woods.
"Sister," gasped Joe. "My father! I just saw my father!"
"No, Joe. No, you didn't."
"He's up there in the woods. I saw him. I want to go up there, sister."
"He isn't your father, Joe. He doesn't know you. He doesn't want to see you."
"He's one of my people, sister."
"You can't go up there, Joe, and you can't stay here." She took him by the arm to make him move.
"Joe, you're being a bad boy, Joe."
Joe obeyed numbly. He didn't speak again for the remainder of the walk, which brought them home by another route, far from the school. No one else had seen his wonderful father, or believed that Joe had. Not until prayers that night did he burst into tears. At 10 o'clock, the young nun found his cot empty. Under a great spread net that was laced with rags, an artillery piece squatted in the woods, black and oily, its muzzle thrust at the night sky. Trucks and the rest of the battery were hidden higher on the slope. Joe watched and listened tremblingly through a thin screen of shrubs as the soldiers, indistinct in the darkness, dug in around their gun. The words he overheard made no sense to him.
"Sergeant, why we gotta dig in when we're moving out in the morning, and it's just maneuvers anyhow? Seems like we could kind of conserve our strength and just scratch around a little to show where we'd have dug, if there was any sense to it.
For all you know, boy, there may be sense to it before morning," said the sergeant. "You got 10 minutes to get to China and bring me back a pigtail. Hear?"
The sergeant stepped into the patch of moonlight, his hands on his hips, his big shoulders back, the image of an emperor. Joe saw that it was the same man he'd marveled at in the afternoon. The sergeant listened with satisfaction to the sounds of digging, and then, to Joe's alarm, strode toward Joe's hiding place. Joe didn't move a muscle until the big boot struck his side.
"Ah!
Who's that?"
The sergeant snatched Joe from the ground and set him on his feet hard.
"My golly, boy, what you doing here? Scoot! Go on home. This ain't no place for kids to be playing."
He shined a flashlight in Joe's face.
"Doggone," he muttered. "Where you come from?"
He held Joe at arm's length and shook him gently like a rag doll.
"Boy, how'd you get here? Swim?"
Joe stammered in German that he was looking for his father.
"Come on, how'd you get here? What are you doing? Where's your mammy?" "What you got there, sergeant?" said a voice in the dark. "Don't rightly know what to call it," said the sergeant. "Talks like a kraut and dresses like a kraut, but just look at it a minute."
Soon, a dozen men stood in a circle around Joe, talking loudly, then softly, to him, as though they thought getting through to him were a question of tone. Every time Joe tried to explain his mission, they laughed in amazement.
"How he learned German? Tell me that." "Where your daddy, boy? Where your mammy, boy? Spreckens it Dutch, boy? Looky there. See him nod? He talks it all right. Oh, you're fluent, man. Mighty fluent. Ask him some more."
"Go get the lieutenant," said the sergeant.
He can talk to this boy and understand what he's trying to say. Look at him shake, scared to death. Come here, boy, don't be afraid now. He enclosed Joe in his great arms. Just take it easy now. Everything's going to be all right. See what got? By golly, I don't believe the boy's ever seen chocolate before. Go on, taste it. It won't hurt you.
Joe, safe in a fort of bone and sinew, ringed by luminous eyes, bit into the chocolate bar. The pink lining of his mouth and then his whole soul was flooded with warm, rich pleasure, and he beamed.
He smiled. Look at him light up. Doggone if he didn't stumble right into heaven, I mean.
Talk about displaced persons, said the sergeant, hugging Joe. This is the most displaced little old person I ever saw. Upside down and inside out and every which way. Here, boy, here's some more chocolate.
Don't give him no more, said the sergeant reproachfully. You want to make him sick?
Nah, Sarge, nah. Don't want to make him sick. No, sir.
What's going on here?
The lieutenant, a small, elegant Negro, the beam of his flashlight dancing before him, approached the group.
Got a little boy here, Lieutenant, said the sergeant. Just wandered into the battery. Must have crawled past the guards.
Well, send him on home, Sergeant.
Yes, sir, I planned to.
He cleared his throat.
But this ain't no ordinary little boy, Lieutenant.
He opened his arms so that the light fell on Joe's face. The lieutenant laughed incredulously and knelt before Joe.
How'd you get here?
All he talks is German, Lieutenant, said the sergeant.
Where's your home? Said the lieutenant in German. Over more water than you've ever seen, said Joe.
Where do you come from?
God made me, said Joe.
This boy is going to be a lawyer when he grows up, said the lieutenant in English.
Now, listen to me, he said to Joe. What's your name, and where are your people?
Joe Lewis, said Joe. And you are my people. I ran away from the orphanage because I belong with you.
The lieutenant stood, shaking his head, and translated what Joe had said. The woods echoed with glee. Joe Lewis! I thought he was awful big and powerful-looking. Just keep away from that left, that's all. If he's Joe, he's sure found his people. He's got us there.
Shut up, commanded the sergeant suddenly. All of you just shut up. This ain't no joke. Ain't nothing funny in it. Boy's all alone in the world. Ain't no joke.
A small voice finally broke the solemn silence that followed.
Nah, ain't no joke at all.
We better take the jeep and run him back into town, Sergeant, said the lieutenant. Corporal Jackson, you're in charge. You tell him Joe was a good boy, said Jackson.
Now, Joe, said the lieutenant in German softly, you come with the sergeant and me. We'll take you home.
Joe dug his fingers into the sergeant's forearms. Papa, no, Papa, I want to stay with you.
Look, sonny, I ain't your papa, said the sergeant helplessly. I ain't your papa.
Papa.
Man, he's glued to you, ain't he, Sergeant? Said a soldier. Looks like you ain't never going to pry him loose. You got yourself a boy there, Sarge, and he's got himself a papa.
The sergeant walked over to the jeep with Joe in his arms.
Come on now, he said. You let go, little Joe, so I can drive. I can't drive with you hanging on, Joe. You sit in the lieutenant's lap right next to me.
The group formed again around the jeep, gravely now, watching the sergeant try to coax Joe into letting go.
I don't want to get tough, Joe. Come on. Take it easy, Joe. Let go now, Joe, so I can drive. See, I can't steer or nothing with you hanging on right there.
Papa.
Come on over to my lap, Joe, said the lieutenant in German.
Papa.
Joe, Joe, looky, said a soldier. Chocolate. Want some more chocolate, Joe? See? Whole bar, Joe. All yours.
Just let go the sergeant and move over into the lieutenant's lap.
Joe tightened his grip on the sergeant.
Don't put the chocolate back in your pocket, man. Give it to Joe anyways, said a soldier angrily. Somebody, go get a case of D-bars off the truck and throw them in the back for Joe. Give that boy chocolate enough for the next 20 years.
Look, Joe, said another soldier. Ever see a wristwatch? Look at the wristwatch, Joe. See it glow, boy? Move over in the lieutenant's lap, and I'll let you listen to it tick. Tick, 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 Joe. Come on. Want to listen?
Joe didn't move. The soldier handed the watch to him.
Here, Joe. You take it anyway. It's yours.
He walked away quickly.
Man, somebody called after him, you crazy? You paid $50 for that watch. What business a little boy got with any $50 watch?
No, I ain't crazy. Neither one of us crazy, I guess.
Joe, want a knife? You got to promise to be careful with it now. Always cut away from yourself. Hear? Lieutenant, when you get back, you tell him always cut away from himself.
I don't want to go back. I want to stay with Papa, said Joe tearfully.
Soldiers can't take little boys with them, Joe, said the lieutenant in German. And we're leaving early in the morning.
Will you come back for me? Said Joe.
We'll come back if we can, Joe. Soldiers never know where they'll be from one day to the next. We'll come back for a visit if we can.
Can we give old Joe this case of D-bars, Lieutenant?
Said a soldier, carrying a cardboard carton of chocolate bars. Don't ask me, said the lieutenant. I don't know anything about it. I never saw anything of any case of D-bars, never heard anything about it.
Yes, sir.
The soldier laid his burden down on the jeep's back seat.
He ain't gonna let go, said the sergeant miserably.
You drive, Lieutenant, and me and Joe will sit over there.
The lieutenant and the sergeant changed places, and the jeep began to move.
Bye, Joe.
You be a good boy, Joe.
Don't you eat all that chocolate at once, you hear?
Ma, don't cry, Joe. Give us a smile. Wider, boy.
That's the stuff.
Joe. Joe. Wake up, Joe.
The voice was that of Peter, the oldest boy in the orphanage, and it echoed damply from the stone walls. Joe sat up, startled. All around his cot were the other orphans, jostling one another for a glimpse of Joe and the treasures by his pillow.
"Where did you get the hat, Joe, and the watch, and the knife?" said Peter. "And what's in the box under your bed?"
Joe felt his head and found a soldier's wool-knit cap there.
"Papa,"
he mumbled sleepily.
"Papa,"
mocked Peter, laughing.
"Yes," said Joe. "Last night I went to see my papa, Peter." "Could he speak German, Joe?"
said a little girl wonderingly.
"No, but his friend could," said Joe.
"He didn't see his father," said Peter. "Your father is far, far away and will never come back. He probably doesn't even know you're alive."
"What did he look like?" said the girl.
Joe glanced thoughtfully around the room.
"Papa is as high as this ceiling," he said at last. "He is wider than that door."
Triumphantly, he took a bar of chocolate from under his pillow.
"And as brown as that."
He held out the bar to the others.
"Go on, have some. There's plenty more."
"He doesn't look anything like that," said Peter.
"You aren't telling the truth, Joe." "My papa has a pistol as big as this bed, almost, Peter," said Joe happily. "And a cannon as big as this house. And there were hundreds and hundreds like him."
Somebody played a joke on you, Joe, said Peter. He wasn't your father. How do you know he wasn't fooling you? Because he cried when he left me, said Joe simply. And he promised to take me back home, across the water, as fast as he could. He smiled airily. Not like the river, Peter. Across more water than you've ever seen. He promised, and then I let him go.
Report on the Barnhouse Effect, read by Tony Roberts.
Let me begin by saying that I don't know any more about where Professor Arthur Barnhouse is hiding than anyone else does. Save for one short, enigmatic message left in my mailbox on Christmas Eve, I have not heard from him since his disappearance a year and a half ago. What's more, readers of this article will be disappointed if they expect to learn how they can bring about the so-called Barnhouse effect. If I were able and willing to give away that secret, I would certainly be something more important than a psychology instructor. I have been urged to write this report because I did research under the professor's direction, and because I was the first to learn of his astonishing discovery. But while I was his student, I was never entrusted with knowledge of how the mental forces could be released and directed. He was unwilling to trust anyone with that information. I would like to point out that the term Barnhouse Effect is a creation of the popular press and was never used by Professor Barnhouse. The name he chose for the phenomenon was dynamo psychism, or force of the mind. I cannot believe that there is a civilized person yet to be convinced that such a force exists, what with its destructive effects on display in every national capital. I think humanity has always had an inkling that this sort of force does exist. It has been common knowledge that some people are luckier than others with inanimate objects like dice. What Professor Barnhouse did was to show that such luck was a measurable force, which in his case could be enormous. By my calculations, the professor was about 55 times more powerful than a Nagasaki-type atomic bomb at the time he went into hiding. He was not bluffing when, on the eve of Operation Brainstorm, he told General Honus Barker, "Sitting here at the dinner table, I'm pretty sure I can flatten anything on Earth, from Joe Lewis to the Great Wall of China." There is an understandable tendency to look upon Professor Barnhouse as a supernatural visitation. The First Church of Barnhouse in Los Angeles has a congregation numbering in the thousands. He is godlike in neither appearance nor intellect. The man who disarms the world is single, shorter than the average American male, stout, and averse to exercise. His IQ is 143, which is good, but certainly not sensational. He is quite mortal, about to celebrate his 40th birthday, and in good health. If he is alone now, the isolation won't bother him too much. He was quiet and shy when I knew him, and seemed to find more companionship in books and music than in his associations at the college. Neither he nor his powers fall outside the sphere of nature. His dynamo psychic radiations are subject to many known physical laws that apply in the field of radio. Hardly a person has not now heard the snarl of Barnhouse static on his home receiver. The radiations are affected by sunspots and variations in the ionosphere. However, they differ from ordinary broadcast waves in several important ways. Their total energy can be brought to bear on any single point the professor chooses, and that energy is undiminished by distance. As a weapon, then, dynamo psychism has an impressive advantage over bacteria and atomic bombs, beyond the fact that it costs nothing to use. It enables the professor to single out critical individuals and objects instead of slaughtering whole populations in the process of maintaining international equilibrium. As General Honus Barker told the House Military Affairs Committee, "Until someone finds Barnhouse, there is no defense against the Barnhouse effect. Efforts to jam or block the radiations have failed. Premier Slazak could have saved himself the fantastic expense of his barnhouse-proof shelter. Despite the shelter's 12-foot-thick lead armor, the Premier has been floored twice while in it. There is talk of screening the population for men potentially as powerful dynamo-psychically as the Professor. Senator Warren Faust demanded funds for this purpose last month with the passionate declaration, "He who rules the Barnhouse effect rules the world." Commissar Kropotnik said much the same thing, so another costly armaments race with a new twist has begun. This race at least has its comical aspects. The world's best gamblers are being coddled by governments like so many nuclear physicists. There may be several hundred persons with dynamo psychic talent on Earth, myself included. But without knowledge of the Professor's technique, they can never be anything but dice table despots. With the secret, it would probably take them 10 years to become dangerous weapons. It took the Professor that long. He who rules the Barnhouse effect is Barnhouse, and will be for some time. Popularly, the age of Barnhouse is said to have begun a year and a half ago on the day of Operation Brainstorm. That was when dynamo psychism became significant politically. Actually, the phenomenon was discovered in May 1942, shortly after the Professor turned down a direct commission in the Army and enlisted as an artillery private. Like X-rays and vulcanized rubber, dynamo psychism was discovered by accident. From time to time, Private Barnhouse was invited to take part in games of chance by his barrack mates. He knew nothing about the games and usually begged off. But one evening, out of social grace, he agreed to shoot craps. It was either terrible or wonderful that he played, depending upon whether or not you like the world as it now is. "Shoot sevens, Pop," someone said. So Pop shot sevens, 10 in a row, to bankrupt the barracks. He retired to his bunk and, as a mathematical exercise, calculated the odds against his feat on the back of a laundry slip. His chances of doing it, he found, were 1 in almost 10 million. Bewildered, he borrowed a pair of dice from the man in the bunk next to his. He tried to roll sevens again, but got only the usual assortment of numbers. He lay back for a moment, then resumed his toying with the dice. He rolled 10 more sevens in a row. He might have dismissed the phenomenon with a low whistle, but the Professor instead mulled over the circumstances surrounding his 2 lucky streaks. There was one single factor in common. On both occasions, the same thought train had flashed through his mind just before he threw the dice. It was that thought train which aligned the Professor's brain cells into what has since become the most powerful weapon on Earth. The soldier in the next bunk gave dynamo psychism its first token of respect. In an understatement certain to bring wry smiles to the faces of the world's dejected demagogues, the soldier said, "You're hotter than a $2 pistol, Pop." Professor Barnhouse was all of that. The dice that did his bidding weighed but a few grams, so the forces involved were minute. But the unmistakable fact that there were such forces was earth-shaking. Professional caution kept him from revealing his discovery immediately. He wanted more facts and a body of theory to go with them. Later, when the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, it was fear that made him hold his peace. At no time were his experiments, as Premier Slazak called them, a bourgeois plot to shackle the true democracies of the world. The Professor didn't know where they were leading. In time, he came to recognize another startling feature of dynamo psychism. Its strength increased with use. Within 6 months, he was able to govern dice thrown by men the length of a barracks distant. By the time of his discharge in 1945, he could knock bricks loose from chimneys 3 miles away. Charges that Professor Barnhouse could have won the last war in a minute, but did not care to do so, are perfectly senseless. When the war ended, he had the range and power of a 37-millimeter cannon, perhaps, certainly no more. His dynamo psychic powers graduated from the small arms class only after his discharge and returned to Wyandotte College. I enrolled in the Wyandotte Graduate School 2 years after the professor had rejoined the faculty. By chance, he was assigned as my thesis advisor. I was unhappy about the assignment, for the professor was, in the eyes of both colleagues and students, a somewhat ridiculous figure. He missed classes or had lapses of memory during lectures. When I arrived, in fact, his shortcomings had passed from the ridiculous to the intolerable. "We're assigning you to Barnhouse as a sort of temporary thing," the Dean of Social Studies told me. He looked apologetic and perplexed. "Brilliant man, Barnhouse, I guess. Difficult to know since his return, perhaps, but his work before the war brought a great deal of credit to our little school." When I reported to the professor's laboratory for the first time, what I saw was more distressing than the gossip. Every surface in the room was covered with dust. Books and apparatus had not been disturbed for months. The professor sat napping at his desk when I entered. The only signs of recent activity were 3 overflowing ashtrays, a pair of scissors, and a morning paper with several items clipped from its front page. As he raised his head to look at me, I saw that his eyes were clouded with fatigue. "Hi," he said. "Just can't seem to get my sleeping done at night." He lighted a cigarette, his hands trembling slightly. "You the young man I'm supposed to help with a thesis?" "Yes, sir," I said. In minutes he converted my misgivings to alarm. "You an overseas veteran?" he asked. "Yes, sir." "Not much left over there, is there?" he frowned. "Enjoy the last war?" "No, sir." "Look like another war to you?" "Kind of, sir." "What can be done about it?" I shrugged. "Looks pretty hopeless." He peered at me intently. "Know anything about international law, the UN, and all that?" "Only what I pick up from the papers." "Same here," he sighed. He showed me a fat scrapbook packed with newspaper clippings. "Never used to pay any attention to international politics. Now I study them the way I used to study rats in mazes. Everybody tells me the same thing. Looks hopeless." "Nothing short of a miracle," I began. "Believe in magic?" he asked sharply. The professor fished 2 dice from his vest pocket. "I will try to roll 2s," he said. He rolled 2s 3 times in a row. "One chance in about 47,000 of that happening. There's a miracle for you." He beamed for an instant, then brought the interview to an end, remarking that he had a class which had begun 10 minutes ago. He was not quick to take me into his confidence, and he said no more about his trick with the dice. I assumed they were loaded and forgot about them. He set me the task of watching male rats cross electrified metal strips to get to food or female rats, an experiment that had been done to everyone's satisfaction in the 1930s. As though the pointlessness of my work were not bad enough, the professor annoyed me further with irrelevant questions. His favorites were, "Think we should have dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima?" And, "Think every new piece of scientific information is a good thing for humanity?" However, I did not feel put upon for long. "Give those poor animals a holiday," he said one morning after I had been with him only a month. "I wish you'd help me look into a more interesting problem, namely, my sanity." I returned the rats to their cages. "What you must do is simple," he said, speaking softly. "Watch the inkwell on my desk. If you see nothing happen to it, say so, and I'll go quietly, relieved, I might add, to the nearest sanitarium." I nodded uncertainly. He locked the laboratory door and drew the blinds so that we were in twilight for a moment. "I'm odd, I know," he said. "It's fear of myself that's made me odd." "I've found you somewhat eccentric, perhaps, but certainly not, if nothing happens to that inkwell, crazy as a bedbug is the only description of me that will do," he interrupted, turning on the overhead lights. His eyes narrowed. To give you an idea of how crazy, I'll tell you what's been running through my mind when I should have been sleeping. I think maybe I can save the world. I think maybe I can make every nation a have-nation and do away with war for good. I think maybe I can clear roads through jungles, irrigate deserts, build dams overnight. Yes, sir. Watch the inkwell. Dutifully and fearfully, I watched. A high-pitched humming seemed to come from the inkwell. Then it began to vibrate alarmingly, and finally to bound about the top of the desk, making two noisy circuits. It stopped, hummed again, glowed red, then popped in splinters with a blue-green flash. Perhaps my hair stood on end. The professor laughed gently. Magnets? I managed to say at last. Wish to heaven it were magnets, he murmured. It was then that he told me of dynamo-psychism. He knew only that there was such a force. He could not explain it. It's me and it's me alone. It's awful. I'd say it was amazing and wonderful, I cried. If all I could do was make inkwells dance, I'd be tickled silly with the whole business. He shrugged disconsolately. But I'm no toy, my boy. If you like, we can drive around the neighborhood and I'll show you what I mean. He told me about pulverized boulders, shattered oaks, and abandoned farm buildings demolished within a 50-mile radius of the campus. Did every bit of it sitting right here, just thinking, not even thinking hard. He scratched his head nervously. I have never dared to concentrate as hard as I can for fear of the damage I might do. I'm to the point where a mere whim is a blockbuster. There was a depressing pause. Up until a few days ago, I've thought it best to keep my secret for fear of what use it might be put to, he continued. Now I realize that I haven't any more right to it than a man has a right to own an atomic bomb. He fumbled through a heap of papers,